in the overall program put together describing the conference. We call this a session dealing with strategies and alternative futures for Alaska. The purpose was to take up some of the concerns that cut across all of the other parts of the program, so that the excursion in the methodology had a purpose. Mr. Oblisacker's interesting way of describing how he deals with incipient institutions that are taking shape in his state was another part of our approach, recognizing that if Alaska is in transition, as most of its students say, the transition is toward a situation in which it will have to develop new organizations and build new institutions in order to manage its social and economic development. I come here to this other session dealing with strategies. It did seem useful for us to talk about fiscal policy. We discussed fiscal policy at the opening session, but we didn't come to any conclusions and we didn't get too deeply into it, so that our purpose this time is to get a lot more deeply into this matter of a fiscal policy. We entitled the topic The Evolution of a Fiscal Policy for Future Alaska, recognizing that the fiscal policy that's presently in force is not going to meet the demands of the future, and this we supplemented with the statement, the impact of socio-economic developments upon the future fiscal strategy of the state. Now, we're not going to hold Dick Metzer to this particular topic. I have a habit of stating topics that often the people who visit us find difficult to deal with, and I don't propose to insist that Dick stick particularly to the topic that we are saddling him with. I did have some notes. The process of the day, I seem to have lost them. I wanted to bring us up to date on one or two things about the meeting. Maybe I'll find them in the course. Well, I'll find them. I'll come back to it later on. I think almost everybody's here now. Dick is going to be here. Dick Metzer is Dean of the Graduate School of Public Finance at New York University. Dr. Metzer is, as I mentioned this morning, like George Rogers and Paul Oblisacker, a product of Harvard University. He is a foremost scholar of public finance. In the course of his career, a rather brief career, he's been consultant to an extraordinary number of municipalities and states and countries. Most recently, having worked with Colombia, South America, and with Venezuela, South America. He is a consultant for the state of New York and to the city of New York, a student of public finance who has been seriously interested in what is happening here in Alaska. I'm very pleased that Dick would come up here and talk with us about what he sees to be some of the possibilities for fiscal policy.
Thank you, John. I don't feel hemmed in by the selection of the topic or the specification of the topic. What we're really going to do is do something which I think in a way parallels what Paul Oblisacker is doing, and I think George Rogers suggested he's probably going to do the same thing. What I'm going to do is give some background or some elements of a future fiscal strategy in this presentation, and in my presentation tomorrow morning, I will present a strategy or a possible strategy. I'm going to discuss some of the factors that go into it now. Now, I want to preface this by introduction. In reading all the material that John's office has been sending me about Alaska and the reports of policy planning sections of the earlier seminars and the newspapers, I really, again and again, was struck by the unique opportunity that Alaska has to devise a sensible fiscal strategy. We've really got so little excess baggage here in terms of existing institutions and so many evident needs and such potential to revenue on the revenue side. For example, compared to other states, you have got a simplified state-level government structure. You don't have to wrestle with an impossibly complex, antiquated beast that has all sorts of built-in vested interests that, no matter how irrational the system, you can't change it. You have a tax system which, by and large, is characterized by relatively, with the exception of personal income tax, relatively modest rates. You don't tax everything known to the mind of man, which is, in my own state, is the case. Every possible thing anybody has ever thought of taxing is taxed at very high rates. Unlike outside, most of the funds for the support of public services do not come from taxes at all. In 1967-68, the state and all local governments combined had revenues of something a little over $300 million, of which only about $90 million came from taxes, the rest from federal funds and from charges and miscellaneous revenue, including royalties and so on. And that figure of $90 million in taxes in 68, particularly strikes me, if the $900 million oil bonuses were invested in 9% corporate bonds, which is a possible investment right at this moment, that produces $81 million, a little over $80 million a year. In other words, just the interest return on that money would be virtually equally taxed as collective land here throughout the state. This is including local governments, not just the state of Vermont. Another advantage, of course, is that urbanization is relatively new, and many of the decisions on the nature of the organization, the financing, even the technology of public services are still to be made. That's not frozen. There are, with regard to many of the services that are not specifically urban, like education, you also have many options open. And, of course, the largest of all the options, I think, is the fact that you really do have an opportunity to choose among alternative goals, what the whole seminar is all about. You have the opportunity to choose among alternative goals in the use of public funds, what you're after with the use of public funds. I don't think many states are in that position. They're exceedingly circumscribed in what they can do. But I think you do have a lot of opportunity to decide just how heavily to focus on the economists for income distribution, as raising the standard of life of low-income population, just how hard to press economic development, how hard to press urbanization, and what to do about investing in environmental quality. These are decisions that really are, have, the course of events have made in most places in the world for you. It's really done, and there are very marginal possibilities to change those things. But of course, the very fact that the options are so open is really a very imposes a lot of demands on you. For one thing, there is a very serious danger that by not choosing at an early date, explicitly and deliberately, among the options, you will stumble into the same kinds of difficulties that other regions have experienced. One of the things I noted from reading this big, long, blue-green thing, the summary of policy decisions, there are just a fair number of cases in which there seems to be really unawareness of mistakes elsewhere, lack of learning from mistakes elsewhere. There are specific proposals for doing things that have been done and are thoroughly discredited in other places. And it's very easy just to allow yourself, like piecemeal, not choosing alternatives, not choosing an option, just piecemeal patching up of things to find yourself in a position where you're almost compelled to repeat the same mistakes again and again. Another thing, as far as the fiscal strategy is concerned, it's a consequence of all the openness of these options, is you simply can't analyze fiscal policies in simplistic terms, like how to get X dollars more revenue, or which taxes to cut, or how much more to spend on a given service. But you have to evaluate each step in the light of the larger goal. You have to weight the larger goal of public policy in some way, and do this rather explicitly. Again, unless you do that, you will stumble into all the mistakes made elsewhere. Now, what I'd like to do with the remainder of my time is to focus on a few issues or factors, some of which are more or less self-evident, factors or issues that have an important bearing on the fiscal strategy. Things that you'll have to take into account in any case, but that should be faced, I think, explicitly as a matter of deliberate public policy choice. One such factor, I think, from my reading of the policy planning section's recommendation, seems to be by far the most important one, is the extremely large income and wealth differentials by ethnic and geographic, combined with geographic differences in the state. Unless you're content to do nothing about this, and I think it's pretty clear that you people are not so content, the kinds of revenue sources the state uses, the types of expenditure programs given priority, will have to work towards equalization of economic and well-being among persons and regions. And I think that one should not underestimate the extent to which you can do this. We talk about, I don't want me to focus just on the oil money, but if you think in terms of the oil money, think in terms of, let us say, spending over the next several years, having available for expenditure over the period of, say, the next decade of in excess of $500 per capita annually from that source, that $500 per capita is a very large increment, whether providing services or in cash aid or what have you. It's a very large increment for money income of people in the poorer parts of the state. The figures I've seen are for the Western Alaska districts, per capita income in 1967 was $750. There's a very large potential for doing a lot about this. This is important not just from the standpoint of what kinds of programs should one adopt and which are most effective, decide which are most effective in equalization of economic well-being, but and what kinds of taxes should one avoid or promote. But it also affects the structure of government, which governments should have a responsibility. I think it's very clear here that if there is really serious concern about the distribution of income, the state government must have a really dominant role in the fiscal affairs of Alaska, not the local governments. The local governments are simply too small an arena in which to accomplish the necessary equalization of economic well-being, economic opportunity. Now, only the state government is large enough in its coverage to affect this geographic equalization. Now, this is simply not the case. This is not the experience. This is not the way the structure of government works in the lower 48. It just doesn't work in most of the states outside the southeastern part of the country. Local governments have a dominant role in the fiscal affairs of their respective states. They are more important in most fiscal dimensions than is the state government. Now, as I began to think about what I would talk about here, I thought of a possible scope for pushing local self-government and the local role in fiscal policy, simply because, focusing on urban areas as I tend to do initially, because Alaska's urban areas are so isolated from one another. There are very few geographic spillovers among the very few geographic relationships among the at least as far as public services are concerned, among the areas. The contrast, I guess, the extreme contrast is probably New Jersey. There's almost nothing that one local government in New Jersey does that doesn't have a large portion of its effects are likely to be outside, occur outside its boundaries. And in many cases, 75 or 80% of everything it does will impact will really be outside its boundaries. Well, that doesn't, of course, happen here, except, of course, there's migration or movement of people among parts of the state. But the case for decision-making at the state level in Alaska, I think, is not that there are all these geographic interrelations, is the need for equalization of economic well-being and opportunity. I think it would be entirely possible to conceive of a very large-scale state revenue-sharing, a state revenue-sharing program, as using whatever fiscal resources the state has to provide big grants unrestricted just to purpose to local governments, to spend on local public services, and then let the Anchorage and Fairbanks and the other larger urban places go on off on their own. But I think the more this is done, the more firmly entrenched will become the institutions and attitudes that militate against really effective equalization of economic opportunity within the state. Now, the second basic factor is different in form in Alaska, but not in substance, from that of an experience outside. And that's the central importance of how the land is used. In the lower 48, high population densities and more urbanization make or should make us worry a great deal about land use and the implications for the quality of life and the efficiency of the functioning of an economy that is urban-oriented. In Alaska, you don't have a density problem. But you have other issues, of course, that are very central in land use, the fragility of ecology in much of the state, the complexity of the tenure ownership questions and the ethnic implications. Land use has to be, I think, a central issue here, too, in devising the fiscal strategy. I think the specific fiscal implications of concern with land use are intentional expenditures that affect land development, like transport expenses for transportation, and for taxes that affect land use directly, notably the property tax. Of course, by standards of the lower 48, property taxes rather low, on the average in Alaska. It's low in terms of the effective rates on the market values of taxable property, that's taking property tax. Total property taxes paid is the same, divided by the estimated market value of taxable property and what is it, the yearly rate you get, and my guess for this is, for 1967-68, the average effective rate is about 1.6% in Alaska, which compares to typical rates in the lower 48 of 2.5% or more, and more than that in urban areas. Of course, the property tax in Alaska is an urban tax, which is not the case in the lower 48. It's also low in terms of the percentage of personal income, in relation to personal income in the state. It's 2.5% personal income versus any average for all 50 states, 4.4%. Very substantially higher. Now, it's low, but it's not to be ignored, for as urbanization proceeds, it's exceptionally easy to sort of inadvertently get into higher and higher property taxes, because the tax increases by small incomes. And whatever land use effect that higher tax has will be taxed much more, land use effect will be much more serious than higher taxes. I am particularly conscious of this here because I have been participating in other seminars that John Osmond has organized, and a number of them in southern cities, that is, southern by my standards, the south of New York, the southeastern part of the United States, where the property tax is relatively low by standards of this average for all 50 states. It's in some cases even lower than in Alaska. But one of the things I discovered in doing some background work, putting together some numbers for those sessions, was that in the urban parts of the South, the importance of the property tax was rather rapidly rising, quite unlike other places. As a formerly non-urban region became more urban, it was going through exactly the same procedure, or exactly the same experiences that other urban areas had gone through, and seemingly learning nothing from their experiences. And property tax, I'm going to return, I want to speak about this tomorrow, about something more about property tax, but it's a concern here, I mentioned it's a concern about the use of land. There are also effects on housing, on income distribution, and on business costs, I think, and all the effects are in very harmful directions, in negative directions. So it is something that has to be worth being concerned about. Now, my mention of business costs brings to mind an obvious and usually greatly exaggerated factor in state fiscal policy decision-making. That is, concern about the effects of alternative tax policy on the state's competitive, what is usually referred to, in quote, and I'm putting quotation marks, the state's competitive position. That is, its ability to attract new and expanded economic activity that is looking for a place to locate and has a freedom of choice about where it's going to locate. I think it's fairly obvious that Alaska's future development does not rest much on the state's ability to attract industry that might otherwise locate outside. There's been this discussion of jumping over the manufacturing stage in any case, and besides, it's quite clear that the manufacturing that Alaska can attract has to do with processing, it has to do with its natural resource endowment, or it's producing for its own market, and it's not going to. It can't engage in, can't be like the state of Mississippi and think of new trick ways to lure industry away from Pennsylvania. It's a very unlikely thing. Thus, tax policy is not really, even if it is significant in the lower 48, it's not a real factor here. However, having said that, I have a caveat. Costs are high in Alaska, and unless there's a good reason for doing so, and there seldom is a good reason for doing so, Alaska should, take advantage of this option not to heavily tax business, that is, not to through taxes on business purchases, on business property, on business receipts, or business earnings, which is, the rest of the country is, very good. As a matter of fact, all countries, not just the United States, but tax collectors are very good at legislative bodies and parliaments and so on are very quick to use business as tax collectors. It's they're hand instruments. They're a lot fewer businesses than there are individuals. They usually keep better financial records, they're more easy to track down, and they're easier to hit over the head and get extra money from. And therefore, we have one tradition, goes back to the beginning of the century, in the United States and in most advanced countries, of having all sorts of taxes on business activity. Alaska, I think, has the option of not following that path. Taxes on business activity, in one sense or another, tend to raise business costs. My own analysis, done for not so much for Alaska, but in other connections, suggests strongly that the taxes on business, which are frequently popular, not solely because businesses are paying tax collectors, but because it's believed that, at least at the state and local level, taxes on business are exported to non-residents. That is, you put it back, if you're, say, Michigan taxes General Motors heavily, the taxes will be largely paid by people who live elsewhere and buy General Motors cars. I think that just doesn't wash, that the principal impact of differential taxes, geographically, differential by state or local area or region, is to raise prices in the community during the taxes or lower incomes in those communities, and very little of the tax rate is actually put on business is actually exported. Taxation of oil companies is a separate matter, because a natural resource taxation. Taxation of natural resources has another character, entirely different character. It's like taxing on land rather than other business taxes. But it seems to me that the consequence of if you do not choose this kind of option, if you just ignore this, if you ignore this alternative and do what everybody else does, you ought to do it again explicitly and know what you're doing, but you ought to be aware that the probability is that you're taxing yourselves, not taxing outsiders. Another basic issue, I think, concerns the financing of expenditures, public expenditures, which are at least alleged to be for developmental services with a developmental character. Services like that open land, like transportation improvements, or permit urban settlement, like water supply and sewage, or protect the environment as development is occurring, like all kinds of things, chemical pollution and so on, even extending to reducing the lead content of ice fog and Fairbanks. Many such services traditionally have been financed, at least in part, by charges imposed on the users. Often a strong case is made for subsidies of such services on the grounds that they do in fact promote development and that this is good. As in most developing places in Alaska, there is a fair amount of subsidies either to the state and local governments or by the federal government of expenditures that have this developmental character. Now, there are a couple of issues here. I think it's important to consider subsidy policies in a larger perspective. Do they really promote what you want to promote? Do individual subsidy policies conflict with or reinforce each other? It's not necessarily the case that they're additive. You can very easily offset the effects of one subsidy by using another. And I think also it's important to consider the specific structure of the kinds of charges employed to finance these things. They said that in very few cases many of these services are not provided free of charge, even though they may be subsidy. There may be subsidy of transportation facilities, but there are landing charges at the airport and so on. And you have to consider just what the specific structure of the user charges employed is here. In most American state and local governments, do just a very bad, ill-informed, and barely rational job with regard to charges and subsidies. And I suspect that the case is not much better in Alaska. But at least you don't have decades of encrusted tradition to fight to try to change things. So let me give you some examples. The question of subsidy policy in general, do the subsidy policies make sense? Do they achieve what you want to? Well, there's a passage in Dr. Rogers' book on Future Alaska on highway finance policy. It's a rather trenchant passage on the argument for a massive highway program to open land. And it turns out, of course, that the great bulk of the actual expenditure on such a program was not to open land at all, but was to improve highway transportation facilities in the already opened areas. Well, that may be perfectly sensible. I would say that if motorists in the Anchorage area want freeways, that may be perfectly appropriate to say government provide the way to pay appropriately for freeways. But the rhetoric, behind this is, not of this kind at all, the rhetoric is that one of the great attributes of the program is its developmental character. Well, I think one has to really examine whether, in fact, it is developmental character. In some cases, we can even find examples of subsidies for public programs that are alleged to be developmental that work in just the opposite way. Now, another example of the other question, the question of the structure of user charges employed. The way governments ordinarily impose charges in connection with pollution, with expenditures to finance expenditures to do something about pollution, just really usually asinine. It has very little relation to the public or private costs imposed by the polluter. Not specific effluent charges, but very sort of blunderbuss charges. My favorite example here is in large cities, use of the property tax to finance water pollution control expenditures, which results in very substantial parts of the tax being raised from office buildings, which are probably the most innocent of all possible sources of pollution there are. I mean, they're expensive property, so they bear high property taxes, but the amount of effluent is tiny, and the pollution problem is just trivial. The whole system of charging and dealing with the whole question of solid waste is just even worse. The point here is that there's a lot that I have a lot of opportunities here in group level policy, and you have not nearly as much tradition to fight to in order to change things. There's another issue related to the question of charges with some broader implications. And this is something that you have been discussing in another forum in previous seminars. This is the question of capital intensity. State and local government in general is undercapitalized in the sense of using more labor and less capital investment, machinery, equipment, structures to some extent, although they're profitable, I guess, with the use of land because there's no dollar cost once the land is acquired. State and local government tend to be land intensive, labor intensive, undercapitalized. They use less, they're less capitalized than would be permitted by the technology that even now is readily accessible to them. And of course, they do very, very little indeed to seek the advances in technology that are only slightly more inaccessible. Now, Alaska is a high-cost place largely because labor is scarce, and the inputs required to keep people going, keep that labor going, have high transport costs, and the climate makes performance of labor-intensive services very difficult and costly. This is why costs are high. I mean, all this suggests that the need for just putting the highest, putting high priorities on increasing capital intensity as new and expanded public services are introduced. That is, you should be willing to bear extremely high initial capital costs if that investment can reduce future running costs. I think that the kinds of calculations, the kinds of decisions on the way in which public services are provided here should be distinctive ones. They should not simply do what everybody else does in the outside and organize things just the same way. And one of the opportunities, one of the characteristics, or one of the consequences, I think, of one of the possibilities, having money that's not, in large amount, that's not committed, is to use this to say, sure, before we were poor and it was desperately hard for us to raise any money, and even so we had to use the cheapest short-term expedient to provide public services. Now we are in a position where we don't have to find the cheapest short-term expedient. We can incur very substantial short-term costs in order to have very significant long-term savings. And I think all the examples one can use are just legion. Just the most casual observation. It's striking to me just to look out the window of this hotel and see single-story parking lots that requires a man on a cloud clearing them out, doing a lot of snow removal, the parking meters that have to be monitored by attendants. All the things that in a high labor cost environment, this kind of climate, there are any number of different ways to do this. The ice wallet in Fairbanks, I understand from conversation with Dr. Rogers that he even had a scheme some years ago for doing something about it, which would involve some investment, but conceivably was workable. The question of all sorts of ways in which there could be investment in greater use of electric energy as a substitute for manpower, and one can say, well, that's electric production of electricity is high cost. Yeah, but it's high cost, certainly high cost if you have difficult transportation costs for fuels and difficult transportation costs for fuel and so on, but there are other places in the world that have met this problem. There's something called nuclear energy around, and its characteristic is it has immense initial capital costs and very low running costs. Seems just ideal for it. In a lot of circumstances, it just seems that very high per capita investment in technology and as advanced as possible might make a lot of sense. Now, this has some interesting implications for this whole question of policy on kinds of user charges and degree of subsidy and so on. The most efficient from the standpoint of the economic use of resources, kinds of charges for services, the charges for anything really, the efficiency results when the price that the consumer has to pay for the service is equal to producing the cost of the resources used up in producing the last unit of that service. And it's pretty obvious why it should be the case that the price is higher than the cost of producing an additional unit of that service or that good. You're asking people to pay more than the cost of society to produce a good. And if people refuse to pay that price, it's just a waste. You've denied somebody the opportunity to use something because he was unwilling to pay more than it really costs to produce. And then if the price is lower than that, you will elicit a demand for the service, and you'll be providing service in excess of what people really want to pay for. What it really costs to society, the resource costs. You'd be better off having resources used in other ways. Well, now, what usually happens is that when a service is produced under conditions of heavy capital intensity, there's a lot of capital and little labor involved in the production process, the cost of producing additional units and service tend to be low relative to the average cost of producing the service. You've got massive amounts of capital employed, and you've got a lot of capacity there, and very little labor used in producing additional units, you just can produce more for very little. This means that if you have a rational system of pricing, there's an economically rational system of pricing, you will charge people only for that cost of producing a large unit, that very low price. And this has strong developmental implications. That means once you put in big slugs of capital, it becomes very cheap to produce additional units, you can push development. But of course, what this means is you're putting in a lot of salt, you have to subsidize the thing. Because if it costs $10 to produce an additional unit of a service, because you've got all this capital investment in place, well, the average cost of producing all the units you've been producing up to that point is $20. If you set the price at $10, you won't cover your costs and you have a loss in the operation. Well, economists would say, well, you should do this, you should have a loss. And where I come back to the really point on capital intensity is to say that this is a possible way of, this is, in many cases, will be a sensible way of investing your resources, your fiscal resources, that is to say, okay, let's use these funds to subsidize the capital investment. We'll make something very capital intensive. We'll put a lot of money into it. But we won't expect to recover this money out of charges imposed on the users. The charges imposed on the users will be what we will use as sound economic principles for the charges, which are developmental, that is, which encourage more use of the service. Very low charges. Now, this is something that very often public agencies are not in a position to do. They can't say, let's forget about the capital costs, because they've got to get that money from some source. And if they don't get that money from charges on the users, they have to raise it from general taxes, and very often taxpayers in general object strenuously to this, because they quite rightly say, whatever the economics of the situation, there's an equity question involved. Why should we have general taxes to cover deficits of providing water supply? This is something that has really very, it's a very capital intensive enterprise, usually very low marginal cost, price on a marginal cost basis. You have big deficits on water supply operations, so why should we do this? Well, the economic answer is yes, you should go ahead and have big deficits and have a low charges. The question of equity is, that why on earth should somebody who lives in a house with a huge lawn and waters it night and day all through the summer months get away with this? Why should the person who lives in a small, perhaps much, who simply doesn't use the water, who lives in a much smaller place, why should he have to pay for this through his general taxes? Well, there are just, you can find dozens and dozens of examples all through the public service of situations in which marginal costs are low and this kind of pricing policy would make sense. And the examples, incidentally, need not be solely found in heavily capital intensive industries. You can find the price, there was some mention of the performing art, the creative arts in the summary of the work of planning sections. If you price a performance for theatrical and musical group on the basis of the average cost of producing that given performance, you have one set of attendance. If you price on the basis, if you say we're going to have a performance in any case, we're going to put up enough money to have a performance, and then we'll charge a price for admission to the performance such that we will have a more sufficient resource allocation. It'll be a very low price, because what it costs, once you decide to put on a performance, what it costs to admit each additional person is very, very small. You have big losses. Those are the background points, factors I want to deal with. And in my session, this presentation tomorrow, I will talk about the specific elements of a design for elastic fiscal policy, the components of the package. And I'm starting off with an examination of the ingredients of what might be called, in quotes, an ideal fiscal system, characterized by being more or less neutral with regard to larger public policy goals. And we'll just leave you with this last thing, because I'm going to spend some time talking about neutrality and neutral next tomorrow. Most state and local fiscal policies are blindly, harmfully, and ignorantly unneutral. And whatever one's goal, there's likely to even approach it a lot more closely if you have a fiscal system which is at the very least benevolently neutral rather than the common practices we have of aggressively and costly unneutral systems.